Welcome back to Head Games with Peter Costas. Peter, that was probably a voice that you recognize, and just give a plug to the Costas McCord Learning Center. Who does most of the teaching there? Is it you or McCord?
We're in a restraining order. We don't let McCord out there, so he can figure out the rest.
Hey, that question that we just heard from Gary was about, you know, who are the people that have the ability to laugh at themselves under the most intense conditions? And he was talking about Fuzzy Zeller and how, you know, he was, I think, shot a 9 on a hole and he's still whistling. Who do you remember during your time that had that unique ability to laugh in the midst of the worst situation?
Wow, that's a great question. I tell you what, it's got to be a short list, because golf's a maddening game when you play it at that level, and you have to perform with so few mistakes. But probably Trevino, I guess, comes to mind from the old school. He was a lot like Fuzzy in the sense that, I mean, he just kept talking. And you could tell when he was really uptight or really angry or anxious, because he would talk like 3 times faster. Instead of 40 words a minute, he'd put in 120 words a minute.
And he'd be saying, you know, this shot right here, I'm gonna hit out the back end of the, got a little slope there, bring it down. And he'd be kind of doing that monologue in between, really just crucifying his caddy at the same time.
Yeah, and the only time that you could frustrate Lou was if there was no one around to hear him. Then he really got frustrated because he felt like there was no reason to talk.
He needed an audience.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hey, let's get to the awards first. I mean, we know who's going to win the top award and who is playing at a level that maybe no one has ever played before. But who's your number two?
Well, I mean, I, based on the fact that he moved into the number two spot in the world rankings, you got to give props to Jim Furyk. I mean, he's turned into a really solid, steady, if not unspectacular, performer. I mean, he's been right there all year long. And, you know, he earned over $7 million this year, so he's got to be there. but clearly, Tiger is, to use the old cliche, he's head and shoulders and maybe hips above everybody else.
Would you say there's a real analogy between him and Roger Federer and what he accomplished in tennis this year?
I think that they are probably identical, except for the fact that one uses a golf club and one uses a racket. I mean, they're individual sports. You know, Federer doesn't have to play against the whole field every week, but, you know, if you look at their records and the number of majors that they've won, Grand Slams in Federer's case, it's almost identical, and I think that that's why they have a mutual respect for each other.
Furyk just won the Sun City Nedbank Challenge in Africa as well. Let's talk about the impact of the year-round game. Peter, do you coach players on how to sort of nuance their schedule so that they don't burn themselves out throughout the year because of all the travel around the world?
Well, I mean, golf in particular, because that's my sport, but I think all sports, your performance starts with controlling your energy level. You have to learn the energy level that allows you to perform your best, and then you have to figure out how to get there on a daily basis in terms of golf, or every Sunday in terms of football, whatever the case may be. I mean, some guys get their energy level up too high and can't perform. A lot of guys have it too low and can't perform. So you have to identify it, and then you have to be able to repeat it. And in golf, that's a very, very difficult thing. Jack Nicklaus first, I think, identified this phenomenon, and he cherry-picked the tour way back in the 60s. He only played, you know, 15, 16 events, 17 events, because he knew that if he played any more, he couldn't have the right energy level to perform at the level he wanted to. So, we regulate the schedule. We try to stay away from golf courses that the players don't like, because that drains energy from you. We try to stay away from playing too many weeks in a row, because that drains energy from you. And we try to get enough breaks in there where they can go back and get refreshed, get away from the game, work on their technique to re-energize themselves.
Let's give an example, like with Jim Furyk in South Africa. He wins the tournament. Now he's going to make that god-awful long flight back, series of flights back. What kind of time element do you add to the recovery when a guy's coming back from South Africa or, say, from Ireland or Scotland?
Well, it depends on what his schedule is afterwards. I presume he's done. I presume that's the last event for him for the year. So, you know, he's coming back with $1 million in his pocket, which is not a bad way to fly back. And you know, he'll be able to spend time now. He'll be able to take a couple weeks off, probably through Christmas, maybe even through New Year's with the family, and just kind of chill and give himself a chance to just maybe work out and leave the golf clubs alone and get himself re-energized to start, you know, at the beginning of January, he'll have to go to Hawaii to play in the Tournament of Champions. So, you know, he's got plenty of time to recover from that. Now, if he had to go play this week in the World Cup, that would be a whole other issue. That's a very, very difficult thing to do, to cover that many different time zones in that little bit of time and then get yourself ready to play by Thursday.
And you'd advise against that. What about if you were coaching a Jim Furyk with his unique swing? It reminds me of when I was being coached in college, and I was had more of a sidearm, a little bit above sidearm, natural motion. I walked less than one person a game. I had good velocity. I had less than a 1.0 earned run average. And my coach then said, hey, you're tall. Let's have you throw overhand. At what point in a golfer's career is his swing, his natural swing, established and you really can't mess with it?
Probably by age 15, the natural components of the golf swing are there. And if you have a good teacher, he's just going to merely help you along your own natural instincts. In other words, if I were your coach in baseball, I'd have made you a better sidearm pitcher rather than trying to turn you into an overhand pitcher. You can make mechanical changes in the golf swing that make your swing look dramatically different, but you can't take away that essence of feel that you have that was honed when you were a kid, you know, just trying to get the ball up and down and messing around and figuring out any old way to get the ball in the hole to beat the guy next to you. You can't change the instincts like that.
You know, we had a great interview with you a few weeks ago talking about Tiger's putting. I thought that since you are the swing coach, we would be remiss, since you are the man that runs Costas McCord Learning Centers, if we wouldn't take advantage of your insight into putting. Because ultimately, like the field goal kicker this weekend who makes the 46-yarder, the 50-yarder, or indeed the 60-yarder, we had Rob Baronis from Tennessee on Monday's show talking about that.
By the way, how about Gramatica?
How about Gramatica?
Yeah.
And, you know, he didn't jump in the air and sprain his knee either.
Yeah, well, you know, I was waiting for that to happen. I think Parcells put the word out, and all the linemen just grabbed him right away and held him in place.
That was his brother, though. But here's Peter Costas talking about Tiger Woods putting.
Fundamentally sound putting stroke. He's got a new drill. Well, it's not even a new drill. He's just doing it more often now, where he's hitting putts with the right hand only and putting a tee just about an eighth of an inch on either side of the heel or the toe of the putter to make sure that he gets it right down the same path every time. But you're right. I mean, a lot of people equate good-looking golf swings and long irons and long tee shots and whatever to automatic winner, you know, superstardom. And it's not true
So let's go into that some more for those people that can't close. Just like the Carolina Panthers, they're leading in the fourth quarter, but they can't close with that fourth shot, that big putt.
Can you say Sergio Garcia?
Yeah.
Can you say Adam Scott? I mean, as good as Adam Scott's golf swing is and as good as his full shot repertoire is, and the same with Sergio, they should have won a lot more and would have if they were better putters. I mean, ultimately, you have to put the ball in the hole. I don't care how good your offense is to get to the red zone. If you can't convert when you get to the red zone, you're not going to win any games. And it's the same with golf. I don't care how good your game is to get you on the green. If you can't get it from there into the hole, you're not going to win tournaments. It's very simple.
Okay, what is the mentality for practice? Forget about, you know, the actual game itself, but when you're practicing, how do you make the practice situation so effective you can transfer the learning and the kinesthetic feel from the practice tee or the practice putting green to the actual tournament?
Well, I mean, practice is all about feedback. You can't learn without feedback, and the feedback has to be accurate. You know, I've invented a device called the putting professor that I use that tells me exactly what my club face is doing at all times in the stroke. It aims me the same way every time, so I can repeat a stroke. And literally, McCord and I can putt. We can make 100 in a row from 15 feet, both of us can, with this device. And that gives you the feedback to know that the stroke that you're working on is the stroke you want to use. What most people do is they go out and they hit a bunch of putts, and if you drop them in the same place, even if you're aimed incorrectly or standing incorrectly or whatever, your instincts will eventually allow you on the fifth putt or the seventh putt or whichever one to start making some. But the reality is you missed that first one, and that's the only one you get on the golf course. So when you practice, you have to practice with purpose. You have to practice with feedback, and you have to practice slowly. So you only work on one or possibly two things at a time, so you have a chance to feel it, to appreciate it, and to get indoctrinated to it.
We had a great story from our friend Gary McCord about Orville Moody, who actually asked Gary to coach him in his putting, and he walked out to the putting green, and Gary had him throw three balls down. He said, "What are you thinking right now?" And Moody said, "I'm thinking about missing." He said, "Up!" He picked the three balls up and walked away. So, you know, what do you do when a guy is, his confidence is so shot that all he can see is that missed field goal? All he can see is that missed putt coming up.
Well, you have to put him in a situation where you start to see success, because there's no greater motivator than success. I mean, I remember one time at a British Open probably 15 years ago, I was on the putting green and Tom Watson was there, and he was practicing. It was just the beginning of when he started to lose his short putting stroke, and he's just missing them, left, right, short, long, from about 4 feet. And then he finally went over to the cup, and I wouldn't advise this to people because somebody might come out and drag you off by your thumbs, but he pounded down the edge of the cups, you know, and to make the, in essence, he made it concave so that, in essence, the cup, instead of being 4 1/4 inches, was probably 6 or 7 inches. If he got it anywhere near the hole, it would, you know, fold downward into the cup. But he wanted to see success, so he just rammed the edges of the hole down about an inch, and made the hole, in essence, bigger. And that was the mind of a major champion telling you that if you can't create success, you can't feel success. If you can't feel success, you can't think success. And it's just a downward spiral that Orville Moody was in, and a lot of people get in when all they get is negative feedback.
We've had Bob Rotella on the show, and it was fun to ask him about A-Rod. Here's a guy with enormous talent, but in New York, and I believe it's also because it's so difficult to get that sense of sanctuary, that sense of getting away from things when you need to, you know, to get that break, to get that energy break like you talked about earlier in the show. Here's Bob Rotella talking about A-Rod. I wanted your comment about that sort of phenomenon on the tour. It's Rodriguez this year.
You know, I don't really know what's going on with him other than to say that he clearly is feeling some pressure from somewhere. I don't know if it's to live up to his contract, or just the people in New York having adopted him with love the way they have Jeter and some others, or what. But, I mean, the throw he made last week to second base where he just missed by yards.
When you look at A-Rod, who does that remind you of who had enormous Hall of Fame talent but got themselves in such a bad situation?
Oh, wow. Probably... I guess it would be Tom Weisskopf, again, from the old school. I mean, Tom had more talent than you could possibly imagine, but he had to battle inner demons, and those demons eventually prevented him from being, I think, the superstar that he should have been.
We're going to try to help you all listening to be the superstars, at least in terms of being the best you can be, with Peter Kostas from CBS and the Kostas McCord Learning Center. We'll be right back with final thoughts from Peter Kostas on Head Games, and Sports Byline, and the Sirius Satellite Network.